Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, in our past two podcasts, I have been discussing the early life of Eric Arthur Blair, the writer who chose to become the famed author George Orwell. Now, for these podcasts, I relied heavily on the Great Courses lecture series titled George Orwell, A Sage for All Seasons, and the book Orwell, The Authorized Biography. Now, the Great Courses lecturer and the author of this book is Michael Sheldon. I was so enthralled with both that I thought I'd contact Professor Sheldon, who has many other credits to his name, by the way, and just invite him to come on Just the Best Literature to share his in-depth knowledge of Orwell and what led him to write 1984. Now, I thought this would be a long shot, but for today's program, I'm excited to tell you that Michael is on the air with us by telephone. So welcome, Michael.
Good to be here with you.
Oh, yes. We're so happy you're here. Also in the studio is my partner in literature, my wife, Deborah. Welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
Yeah, she retired, so I'm bringing her back to work for a little while. So now let's not waste time. Michael, the reason we decided to discuss 1984 on JBL is hearing some of the pundits, in reference to the COVID-19 lockdown, begin to classify our world as Orwellian. I also heard a comment about a British broadcast saying that people in England were declaring, "We need Big Brother." For me, that is a scary statement. I thought it was time that people, especially young people, should read or reread 1984. Now, in addition, I believe that to truly understand 1984, we need to know Eric Blair's or George Orwell's experiences that led him to write such a prescient novel. So I thought, Michael, that you could lead us in a discussion of what led George Orwell to write 1984. Now, I've talked about his life up through St. Cyprian's, but I noticed in the Great Courses Lecture 23, you mentioned that 1984 includes many aspects of his life. So could you help us understand some of his key life experiences that are the brick and mortar of 1984? So there's my challenge to you, Michael.
Well, if you just think about the phrase Big Brother, it's a childhood phrase. Everybody knows what it means to have an older sibling or an older friend of the family, an uncle, whatever, who thinks they know best for you and tries very hard to get you to follow their advice or their model of behavior. And often that works out, and sometimes it's just bullying. Sometimes the big brother figure in a life is someone who bullies you, who tries to get you to do things by coercion, or who tries to mold you in their image rather than let you become yourself. And I think Orwell felt, even as a boy, that there were lots of people around him, school teachers, other pupils in his class, who were always trying to get him to be not who he really was, but who they wanted him to be. And I think even as a young man, he realized this was an insidious influence, this feeling that people want to help you, but actually what they want to do is lead you. And sometimes that can be good, often it is not, simply because it undermines your own sense of development, your own view of what your life is. So that concept of Big Brother was probably lurking in the back of his mind much of his life. And even at a very excellent school like Eton College, where he went before he would normally have gone on to university. There in England, Eton College, despite the name, was more of a prep school than an actual college. And it prepared the very best of English society for leadership positions, and it was usually assumed people would go on to college, real college, at Oxford or Cambridge. Orwell did not, but even at Eton, where he was given a very good education, he realized that there was a kind of subtle form of coercion, even in the notion that you were there because you were going to become a leader. What if you didn't want to lead? What if you simply wanted to carve out your own path? These are questions that Orwell was always asking. He was a contrarian. He was against the grain of most people's notions of what amounted to success or progress in an ordinary social life. So I think he wanted to be independent. He wanted to be an individual. And often he found that all our institutions, from schools to universities at a higher level to businesses, even religious institutions, and certainly government, interferes way too much in our lives and tries to mold us rather than letting us become who we feel we are or should be. And he fought that. And as a result of, I think, about 25 years of fighting that, by the time he was in his 40s and writing 1984, he was very much aware of how, in the wrong hands, a governmental body, a social institution, a business institution. Today it could be Google or Facebook or a state government, federal government. Any institution that proclaims it has your welfare at heart, but actually just wants to tell you what to do, is something that he was reacting against and wanted to make a very powerful statement for the independence of the individual always to exercise its own will, to realize its own potential, rather than crumble in front of the dictates of a higher power.
Yes, you know, in some ways, I can really relate to that. I just, reading the biography, it's bringing up so many ideas from my own childhood. I grew up in a large Catholic family, and I was sixth out of seven children. I have three older sisters. I had two older brothers and one younger brother. And I remember that when my mom and dad would go shopping, they would put one of them in charge. And I used to hate it because the power would take over. And, you know, I was being commanded to do things that I was never commanded to do when my parents were home. So in some ways, I felt that. And I had bronchial asthma as well. And so it was really a pretty serious problem. I almost died twice from it. So I was kind of really watched over quite a bit. And so when my brothers went off to play baseball, I wasn't allowed because I was allergic to dust. And they went off to play football, I wasn't allowed. When you brought that up about when he was a boy, he spent most of his time reading, especially after Humphrey Dakin, you know, would kind of bully him, take him fishing and then treat him badly. And he only wanted to marry Marjorie anyway, So I was very much aware of those things as a young man. What I think is interesting is I do tend to listen to more conservative news than I do anything else, but it just seems like there is an element even in America developing where people really want to grab power right now. And especially with the COVID-19 things, it just seems like I know I have an older sister who's 79, and she actually lives in Texas, and she called me one day and she says, you know, the thing that upsets me most about this is I've lost my freedoms, you know, with the lockdown. And so I think that's what's causing a lot of the Orwellian comments to come out, is that you know, people are now living in fear because they're afraid they're going to lose their freedoms. And so I don't know what you think about that, but that's one of the reasons why I wanted to get back into 1984 a little bit on the radio.
It really doesn't matter if you're liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, whatever. Orwell's message is geared toward every human being who wants to be free within the limits of freedom that we normally acknowledge, the right to have your sense of autonomy without infringing on someone else's autonomy.
Right.
Be able to pursue your interests without someone coming along and telling you, I'm sorry, you can't collect old comic books, or you can't
right.
sell your stamp collection, or whatever. These seem like minor things, but Orwell always believed that our own personal interests, our own special desires, should be given as much freedom as possible, because we're the best arbiters of what it is that gives us joy or pleasure. And yet, as we all know, there is always somebody willing to get into your business and tell you what to do, even in the most minor things,
yes.
To make fun of you because you like comic books, or to make fun of you because you like stamp collecting. It doesn't matter what the interest is, there's always somebody to tell you no. And Orwell didn't want to listen to that if his ability, his freedom to do that, didn't hurt anyone else. And I think that's what's most remarkable, is that there's so many restrictions that have been imposed on us that don't really have anything to do with the welfare of someone else.
Right.
More about, I think, controlling us.
Right.
And that's something we always have to resist.
Right. I'm not a political person. In fact, I've hated politics all my life. My parents were very political. My dad was Republican. My mother was a Democrat. And sometimes they would get into such disagreements. You know, it's like torture. It was torture for the rest of us. But I certainly believe that we need structure. We need law. We need some type of government. But I know that that Orwell was really concerned about totalitarian government. And I'm really finding Homage to Catalina really very interesting. And in fact, it's kind of forced me into studying, well, what does communism really mean? What does fascism really mean? What does socialism really mean? And I guess I was a little bit surprised to find out that Orwell did consider himself a socialist. But I still think, and you can agree with me or disagree with me, but I still think he did it in his own unique way. I think he had his own unique ideas about what socialism should be.
Yes, and again, it was an individualistic approach to even something that would involve the rest of society, like socialism. It was more the idea that people could work together and still maintain their own individual identities. That simply because you agreed to work together didn't mean that you all had to be the same or think alike or act alike. So he saw the world as a place that ought to get along. People ought to be able to get along with each other. They ought to be able to help each other, but not therefore tell each other necessarily what to do. It was more of a kind of cooperative situation that he imagined. Very English in many ways, and that was the root of his thinking, is that in a kinder, gentler England, such as he imagined in his mind, it would be your neighbors pitching in to help when that was necessary and letting you go your own way otherwise. But yeah. The crucial element, though, in all of this was the freedom to speak out. If you cannot tell people no, if you cannot voice a contrary opinion, that's when things become particularly bad. Because if you don't have that ability to dissent, to say, I will not go along with your ideas, then you become subject to any kind of tyranny. And that's why, for me, his most important statement is this. He said that if liberty means anything, it means the right to tell people what they do not want to hear.
Yes, I agree with that. That, you know, you've used that in your lecture, and that's really true. And I think we're losing that sense, you know, today, is that it seems like there's a narrative out there that you have to follow. And if you don't follow the narrative, then you're not even talked about, even on the news. You know, they have their own narrative. And, you know, to me, that's a big concern.
You know, people will say to you, they'll say, be careful, pick your fights where you really want to hold your ground. Take the turf that you really think is worth holding on to. For me, that freedom of speech, the freedom to tell people what they don't want to hear. It's easy to tell them what they do want to hear.
Right.
The freedom to tell them what they don't want to hear is worth fighting for. That's where you draw the line. When someone starts to tell you that certain speech is forbidden and that certain books or ideas are banned, that's where the real trouble begins. Because the question is, and a lot of people don't ask this question, but it's the biggest question, is who decides? Who decides what is banned? Who decides what is forbidden? Who makes someone the arbiter of all of these powerful decisions? That's where the real power grab takes place. It's the ability to point to others and say, you can't say that. And people are often, I think, misled about what the biggest threat is. They're often diverted by other kinds of controversies that don't really matter. The one that matters, the fight that's worth fighting and that Orwell fought so well, was the fight to say exactly what it is you think and speak freely your own mind, unafraid, and boldly, to say it out loud, not to whisper it, but to say it out loud. And that's really what the fight was about in Homage to Catalonia, about the Spanish Civil War. It was seen as a minor conflict in America, but for Orwell, it was a fight to speak out of, at that time, against fascism. But then it became a fight to speak out against the Soviet allies of the anti-fascist position, who wanted to control everything. They wanted, if it wasn't a matter of knuckling under the fascists, then it became a matter of knuckling under to the communists. And Orwell didn't want to knuckle under to anyone.
Right.
He always wanted to be his own man.
Right.
We all should follow that example.
Yeah, I think the thing that I got from some of that discussion, I think I'm only up through like chapter 7 or 8 in Homage to Catalonia, is that I think he got maybe disillusioned with idealism there in Catalonia, because eventually they turned on him. And,
yes, it was, but it was more just a gut reaction to, again, the heavy hand of people who want to control what you're doing. If you're in a group that's fighting against the fascists, as he was in Spain, Franco's forces were backed by Hitler and Mussolini, then you think, well, everybody's united on this anti-fascist side, and then you find out somebody wants to control that side as well. In that case, it was Stalin and the communists.
Right.
So wherever he turned, he would find that whatever movement he joined, somebody wanted to run it.
Right.
The question became, can you ever create a movement, a fight, that allows people to fight together and yet respects their individuality? And that's still the trick I think we all face, is the Democrats may all say, get behind this candidate, the Republicans may all say, get behind this candidate, and don't express any opposition or doubts or questions, and that never works. It's always bad. You never want to silence your followers. You want them to feel as though they can speak their own minds.
Right.
That's a tough thing to do. It's tough to hold a movement together when you have 1,000 different voices to listen to, or millions of voices.
Right.
But it's not worth the fight if you don't allow that element of dissent.
Right. I think that one of the things also that I remember most that he said, aren't we all socialists? I think he was really kind of put back by it all when he saw all that going on. It was like, I think it really put him off. And one thing I think about Orwell that's interesting, that he still maintained his own deep thinking, and he saw, to him, it was error what was going on. And then, of course, I guess there was even problems back in England, you know, with the way the press was talking about it. And of course, he felt they weren't presenting the right figure, or maybe the right emphasis either. And so, So I think that's where he began to see maybe, you know, the propaganda wars weren't always telling the truth either.
Well, you raise a very interesting question with propaganda, because there you have deliberate lies being told, and part of the importance of silencing people is to keep them from pointing out your lies or your hypocrisy.
Right.
And I think it was the combination of deception and hypocrisy that so troubled him. And of course, in Animal Farm, he puts that so well, where he talks about the whole need of, in a socialist or a communist organization, to treat everyone equally. But as he says, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others.
Yes, right, yes.
It always evolves mm-hmm. situation where there are a few who say, yes, I'm here to help all of you, but, you know, because I'm helping you, I'm a little more important, so I don't have to actually do what I'm telling you to do. You can see some of this now in the COVID situation, where we have people telling us that we have to stay at home, and they're out wandering around all over the place and telling us we have to wear this and wear that, and then they do whatever they please.
Yeah.
So it's if you're the leader, and your sermon is equality, you need to act in accordance with your sermon. If all animals are equal, then that's the answer. Not some are more equal than others.
Right. Well, I have a daughter that lives in Stratford upon Avon, and I guess we don't need to bring up names, but the modeler over there, when he got caught, you know, traveling all around London, that just set a lot of people off. You know, so I kind of have a little window into Britain. I love Britain, by the way, and my daughter's been living there for 10 years, so I've had opportunity to go there, you know, quite often. You know, it does get kind of ridiculous when you find out. I mean, even this whole thing with the protests. I mean, we have no problem with people protesting, you know, peacefully. Of course, we've been told everything is peaceful, but if you look on your news, you can see it's not that peaceful. The point is, there was, you know, just about 3 weeks ago, everything was COVID-19, and you better not be out, you better be 6 feet apart, and you better have your mask on. But now those medical people are saying, hey, well, because it's Black Lives Matter, it's good to get out there and protest, so don't worry about COVID-19. But all of you other people, if you're not out protesting, you better stay home. You know, that was the message for us here in Oklahoma. And so to me, George Orwell would be turning over in his grave if he heard some of that. You know, so.
Well, it's always about the honesty of the message. It's not necessarily that any one message is privileged over another. It's the willingness of the person with the message to let that message be opposed, to let it be questioned, to let it be to let doubt be cast upon it. In other words, if the message is good enough, it can withstand scrutiny.
Yeah.
If it's a bad, dishonest message, it falls apart under scrutiny.
Yeah.
So what you usually find, no matter what the message is, the message could be left, right, middle, center, you find the people with the message are saying, here's my message, now don't question it. Or here's my message, don't look to see if I'm following it. And all of that is dead wrong, should be called out, and that's what I think 1984 and Animal Farm and most of Orwell's great essays inspire us to do. They inspire us to stand up and say to anyone telling us what to do, prove it, explain it, let me question it, let me look all around it and see if I can find cracks in it. Don't tell me I have to just accept it without question, or that I can't look to see whether you are following your own message.
Right.
These seem almost common sense measures, but when you're forced to look at the intimidating tactics that are used to silence people, that's when you have to say, don't tell me what I can or cannot say. It's only through open discussion that we get anywhere near a common truth.
Right. Right. You know, I think even George Washington, he saw the problems with two-party system, and he didn't want one. he didn't really want a two-party system. I think he wanted everyone to kind of work together have elections that way. So I think there has been some very wise people out there that can see some of the flaws in some of the thinking that we have to even today, and they wanted to prevent that.
Just to throw this in, though, you know what's really bad about this, of course, is that a lot of people understand exactly that their message is suspect or could easily be undermined by doubts and questions. So what they do, and this is what's interesting about the level of deception, is they disguise their speech and they create euphemisms to make it seem as though they're being reasonable or they're casting something in some broad context, where in fact they mean something far more insidious. So, you know, it's the sort of thing where somebody might say, for example, that the CIA was using enhanced interrogation. And that's a fancy phrase to say they were torturing people.
Right.
And if you're torturing people and you might want to make a justification for that, at least use the plain language. Don't pretend that enhanced interrogation is something that it isn't. And you could apply this right, left, and center. Again, it's every side, whenever they feel that they might be doing something open to question and they're afraid of that, they try to put it off by disguising it in some way through some manipulation of speech. And that's what Orwell was particularly good at exposing, that these phrases that people use and don't want them to be questioned are really part of the problem, that they dupe us or cause us to be less eager to expose a hypocrisy or a lie.
Right.
Yeah, that was one of the things I thought was really interesting, was talking about the English language or words, and I forget exactly how you talked, what you said.
It's politics in the English language.
Yeah, politics in the English language. I thought that was really interesting, because words and how we use words are so important. And then if you take out words, like in 1984, they were trying to take out words, so you couldn't think about things. It was just a fascinating way of looking at things. He was just amazing the way Orwell did write that.
Well, and it's a constant. I mean, it was current in Orwell's day. It still is. If you today want to talk about raising my taxes, you don't say that, because that sets people off. So what you do
right.
is you mute it a bit, you disguise it a bit by saying that you're interested in revenue enhancement.
Right.
And so rather than tell somebody I'm going to raise your taxes, you say, well, we've got to consider revenue enhancement. Yeah. And you say, what do you mean by that? I mean raise your taxes. Oh, okay. But they won't say that. They'll come up with a better way to describe something that they know you might more readily oppose, unless they put a little lipstick on the pig.
Right. Oh, that's funny. Lipstick on the pig. Mm-hmm. Well, I know, Michael, here at the college, we do have a small student body, and it's we have a unique program. It's a work-study program, and essentially what they do is they pay about, I think, $4,500 to enter the program, and then what they do is we put them into jobs then where they have to work off their education, so that when they actually graduate, they have no student bill. And we put them into programs like landscaping. We have magazine production. We have editorial where they learn to write. And one of the things that we require of our English comp students, the freshmen, is they have to read politics and the English language. That's one of their required reading. And we want to teach them to think. And, that's kind of like where my job comes in with the English language literature and with Shakespeare, is we really focus on discussion classes where we make them think. It's not so much what I tell them, as I want to know what they think about what they've read. And so essentially when they leave here, our students do really well. They get very good jobs because they know how to communicate. They know how to talk to people. They know how to follow directions. And you know, a lot of the local companies, they cry for our students. They want our students because they work really well in their programs. And you know, so language is so important, and telling, you know, things the way they are, the truth, it really matters. And it really is what the businesses are hunting for, because so many of the students come out can't do that.
Well, yes, and the trouble with trying to control the way that people use language by telling them there are certain words they can't use, or by attacking them for their phrasing or something of that kind, is that you set yourself on the path that Orwell envisioned in 1984, where Big Brother and his government create a special form of language, they call it newspeak, in which steadily the number of vocabulary choices is reduced to about 1,000, so that in the ultimate despotic regime, you end up with people forced to speak to each other with just 1,000 words. And Orwell's idea behind that was, if you limited speech by canceling essentially so many different word choices, you would reduce the language to the point where it was almost impossible to think outside of slogans. Mm-hmm. So that when the Ministry of Truth tells you that it's telling you the truth, when in fact it's only in charge of lying, then it's difficult to get your head around that when you don't have enough word choices to begin to explain it to yourself, much less to anyone else. So I fear sometimes that in society, as we're seeing it now, people are so quick to jump on certain words as triggers, they'll call them. They'll say, if you use this word, it's a trigger. And if you start doing that often enough, you end up with people so afraid to use words that they limit themselves to a certain number of words, a stock of words that become steadily fewer, until the point where it almost becomes impossible to have real communication. And I think, of course, that's the idea. It's easier to control people, yes, when they can't think for themselves, but the reason it becomes harder to think for yourself is that you don't have the words for it anymore.
Right.
It is brilliant in its evil, but it's something that Orwell, I think it will always keep him relevant, managed to put his finger on and say, here's the problem. It isn't just that people want to control you. It's that they've got some very, very clever notions about how to control you. And as they're using these tactics, they'll be so deceptive and so sophisticated, you may not realize what's being done to you until it's too late.
We were just talking, Deborah and I were just talking about the other night that sometimes, like I said, some ways I've done myself a disservice in not studying, let's say, governmental systems more. And then the fact, if you don't understand them, then it is easier to be lied to. You know, if you don't know what's really, like, for example, what socialism is, and there are many different kinds of it. If you don't know what communism is, you know, if you don't know what, let's say, the, you know, we are a democratic republic, if you don't know what that is, you can be lied to very easily because you don't know how it's really supposed to work. And so I think that that Orwell really is onto something there. And maybe if you could talk a little bit about his time with the BBC. I think that's just a fascinating time period for him. He seemed like his life, he had so many different rich experiences, which really made him the writer that he was, I think.
Well, he had the experience twice of working within big institutions. One was in the Imperial Police that worked in India and in some of the lesser Indian possessions like Burma. And he worked out in Burma, of course. And as part of a huge British police presence to try to control their colonial possessions. And then later working at the BBC, where he's in this enormous bureaucratic organization that tries essentially to control the entire communication apparatus through what was then the main form of radio. But a lot of people forget the Brits pretty much pioneered the way for television to through the BBC. And so you're at this the center of these groups that, that are trying to control others. In Burma, it was the police trying to control daily behavior. At the BBC, it was trying to control what it is that people would listen to, the discussions that they would hear, the music they would listen to, the plays that they would hear. And Orwell, in both of these cases, of course, did not fit in. And he didn't fit in because he questioned everything. And if you've ever been someone who likes to question things, you realize quickly other people don't like that. They want you to go along. And Orwell also realized there's a great danger in that, that in order not to offend others, in order to be polite and well-mannered, we often don't rock the boat when we know the boat ought to be rocked. And it's our own good nature sometimes that allows others to take control and power. We don't want to be irritable or aggressive or irritating. We want to appear to be friendly and kindly. But that often is something that others take advantage of in order to enhance their own power. And Orwell learned within the, both the BBC and the Imperial Police that he, that if you really tried to question those big organizations, they would come down on you and you'd soon be gone. Yes. And at the BBC, I think he got part of his idea for creating the notion of Big Brother, because they often would talk at the BBC about it as just being the BB. And I think he thought of that BB, and later in 1984, Big Brother is actually sometimes referred to as BB.
BB.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
The Big Brother.
And
he also had that idea because the BBC had a kind of paternalistic attitude toward its audience. And for that reason, they were sometimes dubbed auntie, or however you want to pronounce it, meaning it was like the image of the BBC was of perhaps an elderly aunt who was spoon-feeding you things that you were supposed to get, whatever was good for you. Mm-hmm. So that notion of the paternalistic force and the BB, all that came together with his own experiences to give him that brilliant idea of creating a force that would try to control you, but tell you the whole time it was for your own good.
Right.
And of course, that's never the case.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's where that character O'Brien is really scary. You know, you've got Big Brother, but then you have O'Brien is the power grabber. Mm-hmm. You know, so I know that's scary.
It's the henchman working under whatever benign image you want to use as the cover. Whatever it is that you want to put up, it could be Queen Victoria for the imperialistic colonial power grab, or it could be Big Brother. Whatever image you want to put up, and however benign you make it seem, it's those henchmen behind the scenes who do the dirty work and who crack the knuckles and make others bend to the will of whatever power is at play.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask you, and we're running down here on time, as it always happens to us, but did George Orwell know Winston Churchill? Did they have any contact?
Personally, no, never met, but they were very much aware of each other. Churchill less so. He was aware of Orwell, the writer, and really only during the 40s was he very much aware of him as a writer. But Orwell was always aware of Churchill. You couldn't avoid Churchill. Churchill was incredibly famous even when Orwell was a boy.
Right.
So, you know, he grew up under the shadow of Winston Churchill.
Right. To me, I think they have similar imaginations because, and like I said, maybe we could talk about this briefly, but it seemed like Winston Churchill really loved history. And yet he had the imagination to take that history and then apply it to current events. And you could see where things were going. And it seems that's the same way that with Orwell, you know, he took his experiences and he internalized them, but then he had the imagination to see, you know, how it was happening in more than just his life, it was happening in society. So it seemed to me that if they'd ever met, they could have at least maybe had some talk together. I know Winston Churchill was a Tory, and I don't think George Orwell was. So,
but they were, the thing they had in common is they were unique combinations of men of thought and action. They were both men who faced fire in battle. Yeah. They were both men who had adventurous hearts and who had been overseas and experienced all kinds of fascinating adventures. But the big difference between them is that Orwell had self-doubt. Churchill did not.
Oh, that's a good way to say it. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So good question.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can we briefly talk about Eileen? Mm-hmm. I mean,
yes.
She seems like such a wonderful person. And how much influence do you think she had on 1984?
Well, especially great influence on Animal Farm, but I think also on 1984, though that was written after her death. But she was the woman who married Orwell in the 1930s and died tragically of a botched operation in 1945.
Right.
And her death really was a great blow to Orwell, but it was also, it obscured later on the fact that she had had a huge influence on a lot of his thinking and a lot of his attitudes. And that shows up especially in the humor and the fancifulness of Animal Farm. But she also was a psychologist. She was a trained psychologist at University College London, and I think a lot of Orwell's fascination with psychology comes from her. She also thought it was important for him to get away and not be bogged down by journalism and a lot of other daily routine, and she urged him to go to a kind of faraway retreat. They had an idea of the Scottish island of Jura, and sure enough, after her death, he, thinking of her words, he went off to Jura, and on that little island out in the Hebrides off the western coast of Scotland, he wrote 1984. And I think in many ways he needed to be isolated to think through what he wanted to say without any outside influences, so that he could speak freely. And Jura gave him that freedom. It's still a very, very remote island. It's about 30 miles long, and he was at one end of it where almost no one is, still no one out there. And when you stand out there and the cold winds of the North Atlantic are blowing in, you feel like you're at the end of the world. It's a very magical but also incredibly isolated place. And it just, I think it took that to give birth to a book as incredible as 1984.
Yeah, so in that sense, I think she really did have a big influence on that book being written. Is there anything else, Michael, that you think from his life that we would need to understand about him that really factored into 1984? I know you talked about St. Cyprian's, which sounds like a boarding school I would never want to go to.
Well, it was, and I actually knew. That's what amazes me, is because I wrote my biography of Orwell when I was still relatively young, I was able to catch a lot of the people who had been to school with Orwell and talk to them, both at Eton and at St. Cyprian's.
That's amazing.
And now it seems to me, I was sort of like the last man who interviewed the Apaches under Geronimo or something.
Right.
It just seems like such a remote period to have, that I knew someone and spoke to someone who was with Orwell at school in 1911.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's odd to look back on all that now.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, when I was in doing my undergraduate work, I was concentrating on 16th and 17th century poets, hoping that I would end up a poet, you know, and you realize after graduating, you're not going to make any money being a poet. So I went to work in business. I was a ghostwriter at Westinghouse Electric Corporation, you know. So now I'm doing what I really want to do, close to my final years. You know, I always
we still plenty of years left.
Yeah, yeah. But I think you're about a year older than I am, Michael. Mm-hmm. But I read your book and I get envious that you had all that experience, you know, talking to all these people. You know, I'd love to be able to talk to people that knew John Donne. You know,
well,
I guess that's never going to happen.
Yes, right.
But you missed your boat on that, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or you know, John Donne, Chaucer.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Bill Shakespeare is still my buddy.
Yeah,
you know, so.
Yeah, and there are just probably only one or two people who knew old Bill who are still around, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I doubt it.
Yeah. So, but anyway.
We're in a period now where it seems to me all the great giants are long gone, and I certainly in literature, and I'm very grateful that I got a chance to speak to a lot of people who knew some of these giants.
Yeah.
Of the early 20th century anyway.
Yeah, I made you 30 years older than you are in my last podcast. In fact, I'll correct it here. I said your biography came out in 61 instead of 91.
No, it was 91. I was only 40 years old when that came out, so now I'm approaching 70, and I still feel as though I've lived a much longer life than I have, simply because I knew so many people and talked to so many people who, you know, were born even in the 19th century.
Yes.
My own grandfather in Oklahoma was born in, he used to say, he was born in IT, Indian Territory, because he was born in Oklahoma before statehood.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
I heard lots of stories growing up about Oklahoma before statehood.
Yeah.
So 1907 seems relatively early to me, because I can remember 1957 going to the state fair in Oklahoma City to celebrate the first 50 years of Oklahoma statehood. So,
wow.
I've been around a while.
Yes.
Well, I'm the same age as you are, so.
Yeah.
And time to live through.
That's right.
Both my mom and dad's family came over from Ireland just before the Civil War, but my great-grandfather, Leahy, who was on my father's side, was a dynamite setter for the coal mines in Pennsylvania. So you know, he was about 12 years old, and I guess they would crawl into the deep pits of the mine, set the dynamite, and crawl out and run as fast as they could. So he lived, and that's why I'm here. So. So.
But yes, he lived. He survived.
He survived. It. Actually, you know what? He actually came to own them. He was a very wealthy man in a certain part of Pennsylvania, and then they lost it all during the Depression. And so we do have our long histories, and in some ways I do feel that I feel sad for a lot of young people today, because they're so caught up in their gadgets, in their internet, in their devices, that one of the reasons why I wanted to start JBL was to get people off their devices. And I said, you need to read a book. I mean, you touch the pages, you smell the pages, you actually write in your books, because they're your best friends. And, you know, so many of them don't even know how to read anymore. They, you know, to pick up a book, you'd think it was like torture.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because one of the experiences I had doing the research for the Orwell biography that has always seemed magical to me was the boys at Eton showed me around the college. The headmaster got them all together for lunch and introduced me and said, would you give him a tour and help him to see what the world was like here for Orwell, because it was still pretty much the same school in terms of its buildings. And so the boys were showing me around, and we actually found in a cupboard of one of the old schoolrooms a book that Orwell had once owned by George Bernard Shaw, and it still had his signature as Eric Blair in that book.
Wow. Oh, that's amazing.
So that's pretty magical.
Yes.
Did they give it to you?
Oh, no.
No.
No, they did not give it to me.
No.
What they did do that I loved was they took me down to the Eton Boathouse, where the boys row on the river. The River Thames runs not only past Eton, but right under the battlements of Windsor Castle, because Windsor's on one side of the river. And so they took me down the river rowing me, and I got to go under those battlements from the middle of the river and to see what that world was like. That was pretty nice.
Oh, I bet.
Amazing. Cool.
Yeah. Well, the English countryside is is tremendous. We've been to Blenheim several times. Like I said, my daughter lives in Stratford, so I get my Shakespeare fix when I go over. And but even that, to me, some of it's getting corrupted. You know, I when I go to see a Shakespeare play, I'd like to hear the whole play, and I'd also like to hear the right words or the true words. I also want you to know I teach Melville. I teach Moby Dick. And so I noticed you have a biography on Melville, which I'm probably going to try and find right away. And
not only that, but now a documentary film shot in beautiful 4K resolution, all on site in the Berkshires where Moby Dick was written. And that's now available on Amazon Prime Video. You just type in Melville in Love, and there's the documentary.
Oh, wow. You know I'll be doing that. I have a big section on Melville coming up, certainly in the fall. I'm also going to have an additional podcast starting in here a few months. And it's just going to be on Shakespeare, and I'm going to call it a Royal Education. Shakespeare's Royal Education. It's going to focus just on the history plays related to the kings. So I'm really looking forward to doing that. So I don't have enough to do, so I just have to keep myself going. You know? And my wife always
gets very worried. Well, if you're thinking about Melville, the documentary, I think, will fascinate you. It's
yes.
It's something that we filmed a year or two ago and have on the circuit of film festivals.
Oh, that's great.
From Miami to Massachusetts to Macau in China, and then finally Amazon Prime picked it up.
Oh, wow, that's
wonderful.
Great.
That's wonderful.
You know, what's really my big challenge in teaching literature is to get people to read it. I mean, this is a required class for them to graduate. It's a, and they always say to me, why do we have to read this? And I said, because the chancellor decided you're going to read it, you know, so. So
sometimes a good film will get their appetites ready for it, so you might try that.
I have found that out. So we do that with the Shakespeare. I do cover Hamlet and Lear, and I cover Julius Caesar, and I usually show them films after they've read it, you know. So I even make them read it in class to make sure that they're understanding what they're reading, so. Well, anyway, Michael, thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and do my conclusion here. And so just thank you very much for coming on and look forward to talking to you again. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. Next time, we'll begin our discussion of the famous classic 1984 by George Orwell. This first selection of our summer series has some eye-opening instruction as to what is happening right now in world governments and on your nightly news. You can buy 1984 at Amazon.com. You can also find a copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.